This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. As George W. Bush's national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice was one of the most vocal proponents of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. On the program today, we're going to talk about now Secretary of State Rice with journalist Marcus Mabry. In his biography of Rice, Twice as Good, Condoleezza Rice and Her Path to Power, Mabry says the close relationship between Rice and the president may be a tragic flaw that has, quote, contributed to many of the administration's foreign policy blunders. In addition to exploring the relationship between Rice and the president, Marcus Mabry tells the story of Rice's life, her early life in the 1950s and 60s in Birmingham, Alabama, her academic successes, her tenure at Stanford, and her political career. It is a story of many accomplishments. It's also a story of a woman who, in public, is buttoned down and buttoned up. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Marcus Mabry. Join our discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Marcus Mabry, our guest, is an award-winning veteran foreign correspondent and editor who is now chief of correspondence for Newsweek. He oversees the magazine's domestic and international bureaus. His work has appeared in several other publications, including Foreign Affairs and The New Republic. He's a former Edward R. Murrow Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. In addition to Twice as Good, he's the author of a memoir, White Bucks and Black Eyed Peas, Coming of Age in White America. Twice as Good, Condoleezza Rice and Her Path to Power is published by Modern Times Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Marcus Mabry, welcome. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. One of the things I was struck by at the outset of your book is the public Condoleezza Rice and the private Condoleezza Rice. And when interviewing friends and family, you say the portrait that emerges is of a woman who's relaxed and funny and who puts her family before even the president she serves. So a couple of questions here at the outset. How did the public persona evolve, and how did she come to keep her personal life so private?
Well, you know, it's a great question, and I think it was one of the greatest surprises to me in the 2 years of researching for the book, the fact that the private Condoleezza Rice was actually such a different person than the public Condoleezza Rice, who many of us have seen, most of us have seen, you know, in congressional testimony and looking incredibly hard often, and often very icy, staring down opponents, and increasingly as the war in Iraq has become increasingly unpopular, not just Democrats, but staring down Republicans, too, who question the administration's policies. So it was very startling for me to discover in those 2 years, interviewing her friends and her family, and indeed, actually, in some of my interviews with Rice herself, to discover this person who was actually much warmer, much more tender, actually, and indeed vulnerable, which is the opposite of what she shows in public. One of the reasons I talk about, when I explain this difference between the two Condoleezza Rices, one of the things I talk about a lot, and this goes back to the very title of the book, is how growing up in Birmingham in a black middle-class environment, raised in a black middle-class family where she was an only child, during segregation, how that made a difference, how that impacted Rice and constructed her, led her to construct this public persona she did, and the difference between the public and the private. These are all traits that really were very prominent in her neighborhood growing up in, you know, the darkest days of Jim Crow. And this ability to compartmentalize, I think, was very key to Rice's survival and I think to her later her subsequent success.
Hmm. When the 16th Street Baptist Church was bombed on a September Sunday in 1963, killing four girls, Condoleezza, then an 8-year-old, felt that blast sitting in her father's church a couple of miles away. How does she describe that time?
You know, it's really interesting, and I actually both dissect in the book the way she describes that time to me and the course of our interviews, and the way she's described it over time, and how the way she describes that childhood, that traumatic part of her childhood, has also changed over time. She had a very strange life. While all this tumult was happening outside, in the world outside her home in Birmingham, she lived in a very cloistered, very protected realm. She actually had a life of piano lessons and ballet lessons and French lessons, you know, as a little black girl growing up in the heart of American apartheid. She didn't know much of that world outside, and it was during that time that her family and her community convinced her that if she was actually twice as good, which again, that's where the title of the book comes from, if she was twice as good, then she could do anything she wanted in life, but she might have to be twice as good as a white child in order to achieve. And it wasn't said with any bitterness. It was said with just a very kind of realpolitik nonchalance. As a black girl, you may have to be twice as good, and that's just the way life is. It's not a sad thing. It's not a victim. It's not doesn't make you a victim. It just means you have to be that good. And so she really took that to heart, and actually I think it became one of the driving motivations, if not the driving motivation in her life and everything she did, was that she would not be found wanting. She would be excellent at all things. What happened is after the bombing in September of 1963, when one of her own little classmates from her kindergarten years before was killed, Denise McNair, and there's a picture of Denise McNair with Reverend Rice, Condoleezza Rice's father, at the beginning of the book. Suddenly, it all became much closer to home. And this is, again, I think, where this crucial ability that Rice has to compartmentalize and to separate what she needs to believe in order to achieve her goals from what reality would tell her develops. She sees the violence outside. The bombs start to come closer and closer to their home in the Titusville section of Birmingham. And suddenly, she can't deny that there is racism out there. She can no longer keep listening to the adults in her neighborhood who've told her, oh, you know, racism exists, but that's not your problem. That's someone else's problem. Racism will never, in effect, interfere with your life. And she believed all this stuff, but when she started to see the violence coming closer and closer, that became harder to believe. So Rice develops what I argue in the book is a kind of mythology of her family having already overcome, having been liberated long before Martin Luther King came and marched to the streets of Birmingham. She decided that they were already safe, and that violence, even while it was getting closer to her, didn't matter and would not affect her life. The ability to do this, which I think on the one hand we can call delusional, but on the other hand we have to acknowledge that Condoleezza Rice, she turned out to be correct, and the adults in her neighborhood turned out to be right. That racism didn't affect her life in a meaningful way. She went on to accomplish historic first and become, of course, Secretary of State, the first black woman to do that, and many other firsts along the way, including being provost of Stanford and national security advisor. She did all these things even though one would have said objectively, looking at reality, these things wouldn't happen. No, you can't imagine that. And she actually stood in front of the White House, the picture on the back of the book, at 8 or 9 years old, and she told her father, and this is a little girl at the time, let's remember, who could not eat a hamburger in downtown Birmingham because of segregation. There were no lunch counters for blacks in downtown Birmingham. But at that time when she could not eat a hamburger in downtown Birmingham, she told her dad in front of the gates of the White House, one day I will be inside that house. It's an extraordinary reality, and again, one would think delusional, but she turned out to be right, and reality, quote-unquote, turned out to be wrong.
Yeah. This photograph of her, she looks so confident as a little girl.
Mm.
And her parents, they told her, you might not be able to sit at the lunch counter, but you can be president.
And that's an extraordinary thing, and she believed it. She willed herself to believe it, despite the tumult and the violence that was happening in her world outside. I think it's a phenomenal a testament to her strength of character. I think it also, and I think, you know, as you discussed, I think these same abilities, these strengths, this ability to deny reality, to believe what you need to believe to succeed and to accomplish your own goals, these same phenomenal strengths which lead to her accomplishments also, once she's in this administration and dealing with the question of invading Iraq, for instance, these same abilities actually become tragic flaws, I think, for her.
Yeah. Rice and George W. Bush are, as you point out in the book, two people from opposite worlds, but you say there are some real crucial ways in which Rice and Bush are more similar than different. How are they similar?
You know, it's amazing. He of course, is a scion of a rich Connecticut Yankee family, although he was raised for the most part in Texas. He was born in Connecticut. And he certainly, you know, comes from a long line of American aristocracy, as it were. She was a little girl who was in segregated all-black schools until her family moved from Alabama to Colorado when she was in high school. That was her first time to be in an integrated classroom. And her family was certainly not middle class. They had this amazing ability to convince themselves that they were aristocratic, according to her cousins, on both sides of the family. However, they were decidedly not, as she admitted to me, aristocratic. And yet... they found these similarities that connected them, as one of Rice's friends told me, as her best friend told me. They were Siamese twins connected at the frontal lobe by the end of the 1999-2000 campaign for the presidency. I think the commonalities were both of them having a great sense of faith and a great belief in their religions. Rice as a Presbyterian, Bush as a more evangelical, conservative Christian. But yet, again, this commonality of faith, I think also this ability to ignore reality, to believe what you need to believe, I think both of them shared that. I think also a certain stubbornness and obstinacy to dismiss critics, both of them shared that. And I think these things turned out to be incredibly fundamental. I think Rice actually saw, given her background as a Democrat who converted to Republicanism in 1982, officially transferring parties, Rice saw in Bush, I think, Ronald Reagan on the one hand, this kind of clarity of vision, right and wrong. And he didn't have much experience with foreign policy. He was only the Texas governor at that point, had not traveled much abroad. But Rice thought he had that Reagan clarity of vision of right and wrong. And then she thought he also combined his own father's sense of moderation and intelligence. And Rice, of course, had worked for George H.W. Bush Sr. In his National Security Council under Brent Scowcroft as National Security Advisor. So Rice thought Bush combined the best of Ronald Reagan and the best of his father. And so she thought this man would be a perfect president to lead us into a kind of post-communist new world order, in which Rice was convinced the Clinton administration had failed to capitalize on these advances in liberty since the fall of the Soviet Union, when she was in the White House, when she played a role in the reunification of Germany. So she thought George W. Bush was going to be, you know, the best foreign policy president we'd ever had.
Mm. How does she talk about her time in the administration of George W. Bush's father, George H.W. Bush?
You know, she actually talks about it as kind of she was very young when she started in that administration. At that point, she was only in her early 30s, and she was actually, because Brent Scowcroft, a dear friend of the first President Bush and his national security advisor, Brent Scowcroft had seen Condoleezza Rice at Stanford when she was a young professor and had been so impressed with the way she argued about foreign policy, and not what she said, as Scowcroft said to me, but how she said it, how she assembled complex realities and presented them in simplistic ways that were easily understandable and very smart and analytically. That's what impressed him. Again, it wasn't it wasn't her intellect as much as her ability to present and to synthesize. So this made Scowcroft decide that Rice was a young woman who he wanted to propel forward in her career. So he picked her out from anonymity and made her a part of the foreign policy A-list. That's what happened. And so when his good friend George H.W. Bush became president, Scowcroft brought Rice to Washington and made her actually the head at the National Security Council of Soviet and Eastern European policy. This is during the Cold War. It was toward the end of the Cold War. We didn't know that at the time. Only in hindsight was that clear. So Rice was actually playing a leading role in forming superpower policy, the most important and critical foreign policy issue that was facing the United States at that time. Rice very quickly proved herself to be invaluable to that administration. And in that administration, she was shown by her admission that when America was principled in its leadership and when it expressed strong values, as George H.W. Bush was doing at that point, she felt we could affect positive change. She felt very much that George H.W. Bush had ushered in the end of the Soviet Union. She felt that it was his ability to be courageous and say, okay, we're going to go out and we're going to say that the United States stands squarely on the side of the Eastern European satellite nations who are arresting themselves from the Russian orbit. Rice believed that Bush's courage in doing that, when lots of people were saying we shouldn't risk it, it's going to be a more unstable world with the Soviet Union, weaker than it is today. At least now we understand there are two superpowers. It leads to certain stability. And yet George H.W. Bush said, no, we must stand on the side of freedom. And Rice was very impressed with his principled stand, and she felt it led to a positive evolution toward freedom in Eastern Europe and then ultimately in the Soviet Union with its collapse. That, I think, greatly informed, again, what Rice did when she came to this White House, when she believed that America's principled leadership could lead to greater freedom, had led to greater freedom in Eastern Europe and in Russia. She felt the same thing could happen in Iraq and in the Middle East, I think somewhat simplistically, ignoring her own knowledge of history.
Yeah. How do figures of that administration, George H.W. Bush, size her up today?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. Bryn Scowcroft and I had some very long talks. And General Scowcroft, of course, again, former National Security Advisor for the first President Bush and an early mentor of Condoleezza Rice, he refused to make a direct parallel between his time as National Security Advisor and Rice's, which, of course, was the time in which we went to war in Iraq, and the time in which we were attacked by the terrorists on 9/11, the time in which we formulated a policy that led to, this administration formulated a policy that eventually led to Saddam Hussein's overthrow, and during which they made up the post-war plans, with the results of which we're living with today, still, in Iraq and here in America. Scowcroft refused to criticize Rice, and in the end, Scowcroft was very clear. He said, if the National Security Advisor cannot get the Secretary of State, and of course during George W. Bush's first term, it was Colin Powell, and the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, mm-hmm. if the National Security Advisor cannot get them to work together on American foreign policy, and for instance, on what should the post-war plan for Iraq look like once we've deposed Saddam Hussein, and those plans were not sufficient, Scowcroft says and the fault lies with the president. He said the National Security Advisor cannot make the cabinet ministers get along if the president doesn't do it. And this president, and many people in the administration told me this for the book, this president didn't want that. He didn't want Condoleezza Rice to bring Rumsfeld and Powell before him in the Oval Office so that he could settle their disputes. That's not the way George W. Bush operates. And so as a result, Rice did what she could in her role as National Security Advisor, and when she couldn't get consensus, she kicked the ball down the field and didn't deal with the issue. Now, that led to, I think, for instance, some of the largest problems we had in post-war Iraq. For instance, who was going to run this country once we had deposed Saddam Hussein? That question had never been answered when American troops went into Iraq. And once they had deposed Saddam Hussein, it still had not been answered. And to this day, we're dealing with, again, the consequences of that lack of foresight on the part of the administration. Brent Scowcroft, again, was very clear, too, though. He said that he had said back in 1987, he had said, as part of the Tower Commission, after the Iran-Contra scandal had been exposed in the National Security Council, Brent Scowcroft was on the commission examining that scandal during the Reagan administration. And Scowcroft said that the National Security Advisor's premier job should be to be the skeptic in chief. That's the most important thing the National Security Advisor does. When any policy is proposed by an administration, the National Security Advisor should ask, what happens if this goes wrong? Condoleezza Rice failed to do that, and she failed to do it for many reasons in this first Bush term. And one of the reasons was her relationship with the president. They were very close. Again, they were like Siamese twins, as her best friend told me. And so she felt that it was her job to take this president's general vision, this rather vague vision, but this belief in black and white clarity, moral clarity, and formulate it, translate it into actual policy options. That's what she saw as her role with George W. Bush. That's also how he saw her role. Neither of them saw her role as to be his skeptic, as to question his values or his judgments, or to say, well, Mr. President, maybe we shouldn't do what you think we should do in your gut, in your instincts. And Rice often describes the president to her friends, they tell me, as someone who has great instincts, great kind of native intelligence, rather than book learning or kind of intellectual intelligence we might usually attribute, that we usually talk about when we talk about intelligence. But she felt that her job was to translate his visions and instincts into reality, and I think she was not skeptical enough. I think her overconfidence, I think her ability to ignore objective reality in order to concentrate on what she thought she had to do, and the fact that she and the president both shared those traits, I think all those things added up to a kind of Shakespearean tragedy that led to the mistakes we made in the lead-up to the war and then once we had deposed Saddam Hussein.
In hindsight, does she see it as a failure? I mean, her failings.
No, she doesn't. And this, I think, goes back to your original question about the public versus the private Condoleezza Rice. I think even if she did, she wouldn't be able to admit that. I think one of the lessons of growing up in Birmingham and succeeding and growing up in that very tense racial time in which a young black girl was not supposed to amount to anything, according to the majority opinion, one of the consequences is that Rice is unable or unwilling to show any vulnerability, or, you know, she admits that mistakes have been made, but she will not admit to any specific mistakes on her part as far as not being more skeptical of this president. She will not admit to that. She still believes very strongly that the strategic decision to overthrow Saddam was the right decision. She will argue that vociferously to this day, that we had to do that in order to have any hope of bringing democratic change to the Middle East, because Saddam was the ultimate spoiler. Any other efforts we tried to do to make that region more free, he would have undermined if he had still been there. So she says, despite the mistakes the administration has made, and she does acknowledge there have been mistakes, she still thinks that was the right decision. One of her best friends told me that he thought that one of the lessons of growing up in Birmingham was that you could not show weakness or vulnerability, because any sign of doubt or regret or self-doubt that she showed as a black person, she was taught, this is what her best friend believed, that would be like blood in the shark, blood in the water for sharks. It would lead to attacks and attempts to undermine her. And so she never, ever shows that kind of vulnerability in a public forum, ever.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My guest this afternoon, Marcus Mabry, author of Twice as Good, Condoleezza Rice and Her Path to Power. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now. A listener in Champaign County, line one.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a number of things, as usual. I'd start with, you keep referring to this best friend. Is this the woman that's in this policy position? I actually was trying to eschew the personalist dimension of this somewhat, but since we're so caught up in it, I think I've seen her as a policy person on Africa lately. Is that the person you're referring to?
No, actually, I think you're probably thinking about Jindai Frazier.
I believe that, yeah.
Condoleezza Rice is her mentor, and started being her mentor when Jindai Frazier was a young student at Stanford, actually as an undergrad originally. And
so who is the major informant of her point of view, then, that you've been referring to constantly?
This person is, her best friend is another Stanford professor, a fellow Stanford professor by the name of Chip Blacker. And the interesting thing about Chip is that he did exactly the same job that Condoleezza Rice did in the first George H.W. Bush administration. Chip Blacker did the same job, again, head of Soviet and Eastern European relations at the NSC, at the White House. He did the same thing in the Clinton administration. So Chip is a Democrat and her best friend. He's also gay. Again, which goes somewhat to the difference in Rice's social values versus lots of the Republican base, and including the president. They disagree on things like gay marriage, for instance. But Chip is her best friend.
What I wanted to ask about was her business career. You didn't mention that much, and Wikipedia doesn't actually say when she was on the board. When she started being on the board of directors of Chevron, she was in this, had this portfolio for public policy, and I wanted to know when she was started, because we know now about a lot of stuff going on in Nigeria with the oil interests, but many people knew that quite a long time ago, and it was controversial for her to, I mean, there's a documentary that won an International Press Club award called Chevron, Drilling and Killing in Nigeria, and a lot of this was while Condi Rice nominally had this board of directors seat. I guess she was on Schwab and...
she was on many, many corporate boards, including Chevron and Schwab and Bank of America, and as well as for a brief period, KQED, which is public radio in San Francisco, and also social organizations like the Boys and Girls Club.
Well, focusing back on Chevron, I mean, to my mind, for an African-American woman to be in charge of public policy for Chevron while the oil companies were hiring Nigerian soldiers to attack the Ogoni people, who just basically wanted to get some of the oil wealth and not be absolutely just polluted to very bad conditions from it, without, you know, making any big deal of it, is damning. And the connection to the oil interest is, I think, also relates to other interests besides this quest for democracy that that was supposedly what was informing the attack on Iraq.
Well, you actually raise a lot of good points there, caller. And one of them is that, you know, the emphasis on democratization as a goal of foreign policy. That's a very new thing for Rice, and it was much more, I think, an emphasis once she joined once she joined this current administration than it was before. And I think that was one of his values that he kind of that was transferred to her to some degree. She joined the Chevron board. It would have been either 90 or 91, I believe, shortly after she returned to Stanford, before she became provost, shortly after she returned to Stanford from Bush's father's administration. And at that point, she becomes very close to George Shultz. And Shultz, of course, Reagan's former Secretary of State, Shultz is at this point very active on corporate boards, and Rice gets close to Shultz and tells him she'd like to join some corporate boards. The first one he suggests to her is Chevron. He said, well, how about a big oil company, as he told me, a big bad oil company? And Rice said, well, that would be, according to Shultz, Rice said that would be as interesting a business as any. So that was the first board that she joined. And you know, she never had a great interest in Africa. I think she's had a much greater interest in Africa as Secretary of State, in as much as she's had an interest than ever before. And that goes to the second point, I think, that's inherent in what you're talking about. It's kind of the values of Rice, particularly the values as it pertains to her being an African-American and a woman. It's interesting. I think it's a myth about Rice is that she's not authentically black, for instance. When, in fact, one of the surprises to me in doing the research for the book is that I think actually Rice is quintessentially African-American. I think everything she is results from having been a part of that community, a black middle-class community in Birmingham, when she was a part of it, including this determination to be twice as good, and therefore not to ever show vulnerability, this determination to keep the public and the private very separate. That's a very much a black middle-class value, especially from the segregated South. I think all these things are quintessential to who she is and to her rise, and again, I think many things, these things also end up being some of the tragic flaws that pave the way to the tragedies and to the failures as well.
Want a follow-up caller, and then we'll...
Oh, well, thank you very much. The idea that she was a realpolitik and was more interested in the Czech and the Soviet army and wasn't a democracy builder. I mean, I don't believe George Bush really, in his heart, is that concerned about democracy unless it's defined in a perfectly compatible way to corporate power. So you see where I'm coming from.
Sure.
But it just seems to me that. She had even to have be just to have a humanitarian impulse, and to be on the board of Chevron with, and have the portfolio of public policy, that to not have any interest in what the corporation was doing in the world was, you know, it's fortunate for her that she Bechtel was one of Shultz's other major businesses.
That's right.
It's convenient that she didn't say I'd rather be on Bechtel since then. They've been involved in so many scandals in post-war Iraq, more directly than the oil companies, perhaps. So.
I think you're absolutely right to say that humanitarian interests were not one of her chief concerns, and you know, it's arguable whether they still are. I think it's still much more of an issue about power, and I think, although she's less of a realpolitik person now, perhaps, I think she's really a pragmatist. I think it's always about power for her, whether it's personal power or I think, you know, the power of the nation or otherwise. And I think there's been, again, the mistake has been, the biggest mistake of the administration on foreign policy has been that they went into Iraq attempting to show American power and then to get out very quickly. And instead, what they've shown are the limits of American power. So from realpolitik, the foreign policy so far has failed, I think one has to say. At the same time, Rice's own personal power has increased in this administration to the point where, you know, she's surpassed Don Rumsfeld, and now she's is rivaling Dick Cheney. That's why we have any deal with North Korea about their nuclear weapons. So it's not about humanitarian issues for her. I don't think it ever has been. I think it's about the questions of power.
Speaking of humanitarian issues, how does she talk about the response to Katrina?
Well, it's interesting. You know, she admits that she learned a great deal in the midst of Katrina. I think Katrina was a turning point, a watershed for the nation and for this administration. I think that was where, as I say in the book, that I think the American people, a majority of them, broke faith with George W. Bush and decided that this was not the president they wanted. This is not the nation that they wanted. And I think the incompetence of the administration played a great role in that. Rice, for her own part, she approached Katrina as the Secretary of State. So she understood, and she always has. She's a very linear person, so she doesn't, you know, see kind of things in a holistic manner often. She believed that it wasn't her job to worry about a domestic natural disaster that was, you know, for the Interior or for Homeland Security. It was not a job for the State Department. So Rice, she had delayed her vacation for some weeks at that point. This was her first year of Secretary of State in 2005. And so she actually finally went on her vacation just as Katrina was hitting New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. So she went shopping while, you know, mm-hmm. Katrina's victims were stranded outside the Superdome and the Convention Center in New Orleans. And Rice herself, you know, was surprised by the criticism that was heaped on her by those who said she should not have been shoe shopping at Ferragamo in New York City on her vacation while people were stranded in New Orleans. It took her a while to understand it, but as she said to me, she learned that at that point that she had a role to play, not just as Secretary of State, but as a leader and as a black leader. She had a role to play when so many of the people suffering were African Americans. And she said she learned from that, and I think she did. I think clearly, you know, at one point she said to one of her aides when she was back in Washington and was actually, you know, watching the coverage because she returned from the vacation early once it was clear the magnitude of the disaster. And at one point she said tearfully, you know, "There but for the grace of God go I," when she was watching the images of Katrina. I think she's an incredibly complicated person. The dichotomies and the contradictions are present in every stage of her life. And I think Katrina was one of those places where it was very clear. She was a black Southern person who actually spurred the White House to get moving faster because her office called the White House once they had returned to Washington from Rice's vacation, and they said we're going south. We have to go be with, you know, with Rice's people, and the White House said, well, no one can go before the president goes, and Rice's people said to the White House, well, we have our own planes, you know, we're going to go. And so the White House moved up the president's schedule for his trip down there, and then Rice went right after him. And, you know, she feels this stuff very much as an African-American, but she is so used to divorcing mm-hmm. her politics from her goals. And she does not see any connection between race and politics. She does not believe that African-Americans as a group have any political interest. She doesn't believe that kind of political sense of racial identity. She can't translate. She doesn't speak the language that many African Americans do. And mm-hmm. for that reason, there's this sense that she's not authentically black.
You quote her early in the book in a speech at Stanford in June of 85, where she says, if your first reaction to failure, she's talking to students, if your first reaction, and she's talking to them about the obstacles posed by bigotry, if your first reaction to failure is that prejudice is to blame, if your first thought when you or another minority succeeds is that race or gender or physical disability must have been the patron, if when someone disagrees with you or stands in your way, you immediately suspect that that person is a bigot, you're wrong, is essentially what she's saying.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's fascinating because she started that passage that you just read saying she had been talking to the whole graduating class at Stanford, and then she said, now I would like to address my following remarks specifically to those of you who are women or who are people of color or who are gay or lesbian or who are physically disabled, who at some point in your life will usually see yourself even as a minority because of your identity, your group identity. And so she is addressing those questions, those comments specifically to the minorities, power minorities, one might say, in the audience. And it was quite extraordinary because she goes on to basically say, you know, it doesn't matter in the end. It doesn't matter what obstacles you're faced with. She said, have we taught you at Stanford that your greatest weapon in overcoming discrimination and bigotry is your refusal to be denied? And again, I think this goes to some of the contradictions of Rice. That's such a powerful lesson. And I think if African Americans, if women, I think gays and lesbians and other minorities listen to that message, your greatest weapon in against discrimination is your refusal to be denied, meaning never taking no for an answer, never giving up, meaning understanding that your goals can be achieved and that you're refusing to let anyone keep you from reaching those goals. I think that's an incredibly powerful lesson of Rice. And I think this is why I think we're used to seeing her in very, you know, dichotomous terms. I think either all bad or all good, depending on our own political affiliations. What I was trying to do with this book is explain her, understand who she is and these contradictions that exist in her. But I think that, for instance, and I think it's hard to hear it over our very divided nation right now politically and the great anger against this administration, and I think rightly so, and the role that Rice has played in it. But that lesson is such a powerful one to hear, I think, regardless of the politics of the person saying it. And I think it's often lost because of her failures as a member of this administration. And I think that's one of the interesting things that surprised me, was that she has this kind of core belief that she will not be denied because she's black or female. And I think those are strong lessons, I think, for black parents, and I think for women, and I think for anyone else who's a member of a minority group. I don't think we hear it enough because we see the negative effects of what she's done as a public official.
Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana, line one. Hi. Is there a caller there?
Hello.
Hi.
I found one of the most amazing figures in post-Saddam Iraq to be Paul Bremer, setting an upper limit on the Sunnis in government, but not a lower limit, doling out all this money, and now I guess he's back at the States. So were he and Rice thrown together, or did they have a history?
Well, that's a great question. They do have a history. It was actually Rice finally took a role in Iraq, and I think we have to acknowledge that she actually, and I go into this in great detail in the book, she actually did take a positive role in Iraq once it was clear that we had made these mistakes that are still manifest today in American policy. She actually started to elbow Rumsfeld aside when it was clear that he didn't have a plan for post-war Iraq, and the Defense Department had been in the lead on Iraq. So a lot of these mistakes, once we had toppled Saddam, belonged to the Defense Department. And when Bremer was sent over there to be kind of pro-counsel on behalf of the president, the president's representative in Baghdad, it was Rice who first started to acknowledge that Bremer had not been given sufficient direction from Washington. He had not been given, and now what Rice does not acknowledge is he was not given sufficient direction from Washington because they weren't giving sufficient direction to anyone. The administration didn't have a sufficient plan. That's why Bremer was on his own. And so Rice realized that he was taking all kinds of actions that the administration or someone in Washington, probably the president, should have been consulted on before Bremer made them. And de-Ba'athification was one of those things, where they basically removed the Sunnis from Bremer, basically unilaterally, removed the Sunnis from most of the government structures in the Baghdad. And that was, you know, these were Sunnis who, it's kind of like the Communist Party, you had to belong to the party, be a Ba'athist, even if you know, you did not ideologically believe in them, told many, many positions in the government and civil service. So Bremer gutted the Iraqi civil service without the administration's approval, and so Rice, at that point, moved to curtail him and eventually, get rid of him. She moved to curtail his power and to make it into curtail Rumsfeld's defense departments because she saw they were sending us down a very bad path in Iraq, and she leashed Bremer in, and, you know, he actually, there's a great scene in the book where Rumsfeld, is yelling at Rice and yelling at Bremer and telling Bremer that, telling Rice that Bremer reports to her. And Rice says, well, that's not true. He works for you, Don. that's the chain of command. But Rumsfeld was upset and angry, and that Rice had usurped some of his power. In the end, you know, we actually had elections in Iraq quicker than we would have because Rice actually became more involved in it as National Security Advisor, taking it away from the Defense Department and Bremer.
I'm looking once again at the picture of her on the back of the jacket of your book, Twice as Good. She's a little girl standing in front of the White House. Does she want to be president?
As Chip Blacker, her best friend, said, she's not the one who goes home and whistles hail to the chief, you know, in the privacy of her own bedroom. The amazing thing, one of the many amazing things about Rice is that she has never wanted any of the jobs that she ended up getting. She never wanted to be a professor at Stanford. She never wanted to be a provost at Stanford. She never wanted to be National Security Advisor. And in fact, in the scene I relate in the book, she didn't want to be Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
So the fascinating thing about Rice is that she, you know, she only had one long-term goal in her entire life, really, and that was to play the piano. And she worked diligently at that from the age of 3 till 17. And at 17, and I should note that Condoleezza Rice at 17 was a sophomore in college, which is not normal, but she skipped two grades already, and her mom had homeschooled her for the beginning of her life. Once Rice failed in the one long-term goal she had, which was to be a concert pianist, and she realized that there were little kids who were much better than her, and so she dropped that goal. Well, Rice has never, ever established a long-term goal since then, and that's fascinating to me. Once she failed at that one long-term goal, ever since then, her philosophy has been to work very hard at the task at hand, to do her very best at the task at hand, and not to worry about the future. So she never thinks about the job that comes next. That's never on her mind. It's an enormous discipline, and discipline is one of her, you know, one of the real traits of Condoleezza Rice, of course. But she doesn't think about what comes next. And so when we talked about the presidency, she said, you know, she never had any goal to be president. But she, like I said, she'd never set a long-term goal in her life subsequent to her failure to be a concert pianist when she was 17.
Yeah.
And so I think if it happens, her view is it's God's will.
It is really interesting because she is a day-to-day person,
yes,
but it's always about winning every day.
That's exactly right, and that's a great way to put it. That's what it's about. It's about winning every day, and that's the goal. There is no longer-term goal, no longer-term philosophy at work here.
Yeah. Why do you suppose she gave you these in-depth interviews and encouraged her friends and family to speak with you?
Well, I think it's because, that it was, as Professor Blacker said, it was in her interest to do so. It was clear I was going to write the book regardless. Obviously, her critics would be happy to talk to me, and they were. So if she wanted to have her side of the story told, then she needed to talk to me, and she needed to allow her friends and family to talk to me. And so I'm happy she did because it allowed me to create a much fuller view of Rice, talking to the critics and the supporters, those who oppose the president's policies but who love her, and hearing their perspectives, for instance. So I'm happy she did it. I think Blacker's right. I think it was because it was in her interest to do so.
Mm. There, we'll have to wrap it up. We're out of time. I have so many other questions I'd like to ask you. It's been really good talking with you, Marcus Mabry.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you, Celeste.
Marcus Mabry has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's an award-winning veteran foreign correspondent and editor who is now chief of correspondence for Newsweek. His latest book is Twice as Good, Condoleezza Rice and Her Path to Power, the publisher Modern Times.